Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, SiriusXM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher.
That was an explosion.
He just said, I want to let you all know that I love you very, very much in case I don't see you again. That the plane has been taken over by hijackers. And then I said, well, we love you very much too, Mark. Let me go get your mother.
Tomorrow, America and the world changed the way we lived. The way we viewed our place in the world endured a frightening seismic shift after terrorists hijacked four passenger jets, two crashing into the World Trade Center towers in New York City, one crashing into the Pentagon, the very heart of American military power, and one diving into a lonely field in southwestern Pennsylvania. We all remember where we were and what we were doing on that bright, beautiful Tuesday morning two decades ago. Well, tonight, we will revisit that day with our guests and our listeners and try to put it into perspective. And joining me tonight, Andrea Rayner, chaplain and author of Reflections of Grace, Finding Hope at Ground Zero, and Sonia Ross, founder and editor-in-chief of Black Women Unmuted. We also want to hear from our listeners tonight. Where were you? What were you doing when it all changed for the country and for the world? Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You're welcome to tweet me at HFisherWHUR and follow me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Andrea Rayner and Sonia Ross, thank you both for joining the conversation on this really important day.
Thank you.
Sonia, can you hear me?
Thank you, Harold.
Yeah. Andrea, I want to start with you because you were there. You were in New York. Talk to me about your experience. Where were you? And what were you doing when things changed in New York?
Well, I was serving as a chaplain to a hospice in Westchester County, which was about 20 minutes north of New York City. And on the day of the attack, we had gathered together as a hospice team, like we always did, to hear reports from the night before and to sort of figure out our patients for the day. When our administrative assistant ran in and said a plane had hit the World Trade Center. Like so many people, we figured it was a tour plane that had gotten off course. It was very sad. By the time the second one hit, we knew we were under attack. So immediately we went into triage mode, deciding which patients had to be seen immediately, which could wait, and then began the waiting for injured that we thought surely would come to our hospital because we were one of the first hospitals right outside the city. So we waited, but no, of course, no wounded came. So I went home. My children were in kindergarten and third grade at the time, and it was like a war scene. You know, people were going from parent to parent asking if they'd heard from their husbands or their wives. And as it turned out, we lost, I think, 16 people from our town that day. In the aftermath of that, I began to serve as a chaplain to Ground Zero. I'm United Methodist minister. initially just walking the site, offering support where I could, listening to stories. And by November, I was assigned to the temporary morgue on site, where I offered blessings on remains as they were brought in.
Where was that temporary morgue on site? Paint a picture of specifically what that was when you say on site.
Right. Well, it moved a couple times. Initially, and I arrived around October 2nd. So initially, somebody put a tarp, and it was literally as bodies were being found, they were blessed and brought into, I believe, St. Paul's Chapel. And then there was a small trailer that sat, I think, at Liberty and Bessie Street in the city. And again, you're right on the lip of Ground Zero. Eventually, it was moved, and again, it was a small trailer with two steel tables. We could look out at both the burning towers, and then as it became increasingly the meat pit that was being cleaned up. So we were close to the firehouse station 1010, about a 5-10 minute walk from St. Paul's Chapel. But we were, when I say we were on the site, we were within steps of walking into the rubble.
Sonia, where were you that morning?
I was actually in Florida with President Bush. I was part of the press corps traveling with the president on the last day of a 3-day trip to Florida. And the president was pretty low-key. There wasn't much happening on the 2 days prior. So the only thing on the agenda was a morning visit to an elementary school and a speech about education. And then the president was coming back to Washington.
Tell me about that.
Well, the day began in a rather mundane way. It was a beautiful, beautiful day, very hot in Sarasota. And they were experiencing something called red tide. I don't know if you've ever been through a red tide or not in Florida, but just imagine the stinkiest air possible.
Yes.
And that's what it smelled like in Florida that day. We had been spending a lot of time talking about how funky the red tide was. The president got up very, very early. He went jogging, and then we gathered the travel pool at the hotel where we had been staying and got into a motorcade to go over to Emma Booker Elementary School. The president's limousine was at the very front. I was in a press van that was further back in the motorcade, and my cell phone rang, my colleague I was traveling with, whose name was Scott Lindlaw, was saying, hey, they're saying on CNN here that a plane hit the World Trade Center. I, too, was among that population of people who thought, who flew their small private jet into the World Trade Center on a day like today? The weather was clear. How did they not see those big imposing buildings? You know, I was thinking twin engine Cessna, because there had been a similar incident and prior to this. So I tried to get more information. I called our desk in Washington, and nobody had much detail beyond that at that point. This was during the 8 o'clock hour,
right?
Like sometime after 8:10 or 8:15, but before 8:45. And so I said I'd try to get as much information as I could out of the White House staff. Now, normally when a president is traveling, there's the aides who are traveling with the president, some of them will hang back and try to get the attention of reporters or talk or chitty chat with reporters to share information. But on that particular day, they all disappeared. There was nobody to hit up for details, or hey, have you heard, or does the president know? So we arrived at the school and just went inside. We went to the classroom where the president, you know, they had already been set up for the president to visit. And some of the other reporters who had gone ahead came and met us and said, has the president said anything, or does anybody have anything to say about this explosion and crash in New York? And I said, no, I asked them for details, and they said it was a huge jet that hit the World Trade Center.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew then that we were going to have to get on top of this information and we'll see what the president had to say. So the first shot we were going to have at getting a question to him was in a classroom full of second graders.
Yeah, yeah.
So we were standing in the back.
That had to be short of, you know, what we saw happening in New York at that time. The look on the president's face when his aide came and whispered in his ear as he was sitting there in front of those second graders at the school is probably one of the most iconic things that any of us could see. We are tonight talking about 9/11, 20 years later, how this series of events on September 11th, 2001 has changed America, changed the world, indeed, has changed us. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let's see what Erica has to say. Erica calling from Oxon Hill. Erica, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I'm actually calling from Woodbridge, Virginia. I remember 9/11 because I am still a teacher, but I was teaching at Oxon Hill Middle School in Fort Washington. And I remember it vividly. My principal came over the intercom and told us we were in an emergency. We had to shelter in place. There was to be no movement in the building. We stayed in one class, I think, must have been 2 hours.
Mm.
But we could smell the smoke in
from the Pentagon.
Yes, from the Pentagon. We could smell the smoke, and we could see the smoke in the billowing towards where we were. Because, you know, Fort Washington is right on the cusp once you come across 295. But it was just a surreal experience. I had parents who were trying to come and get their children. A lot of our students, their parents either worked at Andrews Air Force Base or at the Pentagon. We did have a few students who lost their parents there due to the 9/11 attack. It was a very traumatic experience for us.
Erica, thank you for sharing with us. I appreciate that. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810, D. Calling from Alexandria, Virginia. Thanks for calling, Dee. What's on your mind?
Every year I think about this, but I'm from Chicago, and I lived in Chicago at the time. And I will say it was horrifying because I woke up, I went to the gym, normal day, and then I got to work, and I put on my TV, fell asleep, woke up, and saw this plane hitting the tower, and then a live report, and then the second one hit. And I just remember just my whole body just going numb and just running out of work. And I had to go home because I didn't know where to go. And it was the John Hancock, and at the time it was the highest residential high-rise in the world. And so I got home, and they were like, well, we're evacuating. And the doormen were telling us, leave, go anywhere, just leave. And we couldn't go to the Sears Tower. So I went back downtown because I lived and worked downtown, and Mayor Daley was so good. He knew something was wrong right away. He had all the trains turned around, and they were all going back. All buses leave. All cars leave. He had every police officer. The entire city was closed, and you can only show ID to show that you were there. So I went to the youth hostel where I volunteered, and they were like, we've been waiting for you. And they had a room for me, and they said I could stay as long as I want. I didn't have to pay.
Yeah.
And it was just an awful time, and I just remember being very sad. I'm still very sad every time I hear these things. And I will say one thing. It's like when you think of what's going on right now in this world and what's going on in the United States specifically and how divided we are, I think it took something like that, I think, to bring everybody together, because it was the one time when I think everybody came together. It didn't matter what your religion was or what your race was or where you lived. It was just complete, like everybody was on in one thought at one time. Very.
Hopefully we can get to that point again. We're going to take a break, but we're going to continue this conversation, 9/11, 20 years later. This conversation continues on SiriusXM, channel 141 and 96.3, the HD2 app. Stretches in for John Mons with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. This discussion continues in just a few seconds.
Ordered that the full resources of the federal government go to help the victims and their families and to conduct a full-scale investigation to hunt down and to find those folks who committed this act.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our conversation about the 9/11 attacks 20 years later, how it changed America, the world, and us. Our guests are Andrea Rayer, chaplain and author of Reflections of Grace, Finding Hope at Ground Zero, and Sonia Ross, founder and editor-in-chief of Black Women Unmuted. Tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We want to know where you were at the time that this happened. Andrea, talk to me about your first impression when you arrived at Ground Zero, at the temporary morgue, your feelings, particularly as a clergy person.
Well, I felt very honored to be there. I felt, just grateful that there was something that I possibly could do, which was to offer some comfort and, as I said, offer some blessings on the remains that were being brought in. And the powerful thing at the morgue is that there was a 24-hour clergy presence. So I might follow a rabbi who followed an imam who followed a priest. I mean, sounds like a beginning of a joke, but it was a beautiful thing that there were clergy of every faith and denomination and tradition who took 8-hour shifts at the morgue. So when you would go to this little trailer, the first thing I would do is I would check in. There was a large book where the entries were written by hand, so I could see, you know, the date, the time, the name of the place where it was found. It's like the part, the foot, the hand, the breast, you know, the bone that was found at this time, at this part of the site. And it was a heartbreaking travelogue of the lives that were lost. So those parts, as they were brought into the morgue, would be documented. A crime scene officer would photograph, because it was a crime scene. The medical examiner would be called in to try to identify the part of the body if we were uncertain. I never saw a body intact or a body with a head. And then the chaplain would offer a blessing on the remains. And no matter how many remains were brought in, what hour of night it was, everyone who stood there would take off their hat, bow their heads while the blessing was given. And then those remains would be brought to the more permanent morgue for DNA testing and hopefully identification. So it was a very sacred place there. It was heartbreaking. As a hospice chaplain, I thought I was well acquainted with death, but nothing could really prepare you for seeing really the bits and particles of people.
How was your faith not shaken?
I think it certainly was. Any person of faith who isn't shaken, I don't think is really going deep enough to allow that anger or wondering, where is God? Where is God in all of this? And I think partly it was just the fatigue and the needing to kind of compartmentalize to keep going. And the other part was absorbing that feeling at Ground Zero, which was the best of humanity was there to confront the worst of humanity. The most heinous act that had happened there, this feeling of courage and, as the caller said, togetherness, was happening. I actually had a conversation with a Port Authority officer who said he was present when they believed part of the remains of one of the hijackers was found, and I was assumed that they would be, you know, spat upon or you know, desecrated. And he said, no. We said to ourselves, this was still someone's son. And what struck me, Harold, is now 20 years later, we had someone's son crying out for his mother while we watched the life being squeezed out of him with a knee on his neck. And of course, I'm talking about George Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
So that togetherness that the nation had, where, you know, senators and representatives, Republicans and Democrats stood, you know, on the Capitol steps and sang God Bless America, 20 years later, January 6th, you know, we're killing each other. Mm. And so, unfortunately, the legacy of 9/11 hasn't been a sustained togetherness. It has been more Islamophobia. It has been more division. And that is something that we have to confront as Americans.
Mm. Sonia, in reporting, you know, on that day, and as a reporter, you know, you and I have seen some horrific things. I will say, obviously, that this was the worst day and the most significant day of my life as a journalist, and I would argue probably for yourself as well. Even as you were doing your job personally, how did this day impact you, even as you were trying to do your job?
Well, I think for me that particular day, the saving grace had to be my sister. I have routinely given her the credit for being able to, first of all, get through to me on my mobile phone. After the president left the school, he immediately was coming back to Washington. At least that's what we were told. So we were hustling to get out of town. And cell signals, as you know, were very spotty that day, very difficult to get through. But my sister got through from Atlanta as we were driving up to the tarmac to get on Air Force One to leave. I like to think it was divine providence purely that my sister got through. My sister is a minister with the Church of Christ, and she called to find out where I was because she had heard about the Pentagon crash. I had not heard about the plane crashing into the Pentagon at that time. She assumed I knew, and she was just asking me, where are you? Are you safe? And I said, of course I'm safe. I'm with the president, and we are going back. We're in Florida. We're going back to Washington. She immediately said, oh, then we have to pray for traveling mercy.
Mm-hmm.
And she prayed a very, very powerful prayer. My sister is very much a prayer warrior, and she prayed a very powerful prayer about asking God to put the shield of protection over everyone, pleading the blood of Jesus, and put angels on the wings, mobilize the angels to make sure everyone gets home safely. And I think her prayer was a calming thing for me. It helped me to maintain my cool in a day of true stark contrast. You know, it was calm and bucolic pretty much everywhere the president physically was, but the nation itself was in distress.
Absolutely.
In an apocalyptic way. And so having the sense of true raw danger in an environment that was basically very peaceful was a difficult thing in a contrast emotionally for me. So just the fact that I was able to talk to one of my loved ones and relay the message that I was indeed saved, and to get Traveling Mercy prayed for over me before we left meant everything.
Absolutely. Donna, calling from Virginia, quickly, what's on your mind?
Good evening.
Yes, go right ahead.
Well, what's on my mind is it's kind of an eerie thing. I was telling the young lady when I was waiting for my call that on September 11th, I was working with FedEx. I had just gotten off from work. I had stayed to, help pack, label some packages. And I remember waiting for the bus. We were located at Eisenhower Avenue. So I was waiting for the bus, and I remember hearing this loud boom, and I just thought it was construction. But I did think it was unusually loud, which more than likely was the Pentagon. So bus driver shows up, and we had like a free ride that day. And he was saying that the State Department, he was under the impression that the State Department had gotten bombed. So got to Eisenhower Metro Station, and at that time in the morning, which now was around 10, something like that, there were so many military people, and I had never seen that many military people out at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So, still didn't know what had happened. I still didn't even know what was going on. And then I got to Braddock Road, and I see even more people. So, finally get home, see what's going on. The odd thing is I had picked up a newspaper, and the newspaper is dated September 11, 2001, and it is a picture of President Bush at the school prior to all of this happening.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think about that. Like, I have the paper, and it's so, it's one of those eerie things, like, here's this photo is before all of this has happened. So,
It's certainly surreal beyond words, Donna. Thank you so much. I will, to both of you, Andrea, Sonia, and, to our listeners, when this happened, I was the co-anchor for the Fox affiliate in Baltimore at the time. And this was, we were piloting a 3.5-hour news program that included, news and the latest information. But it was also basically a lot of fun. And it just included a lot of silliness, comedians, that kind of it. It was a morning newscast, and it always ended because there was a 10-minute program that it ended right around 9, or I guess I around 8:58. Or something like that. And my co-anchor and I, we were sitting at the desk, and as was the routine, we would sit there and do promos, and the staff would be on the floor, and they would cut up with us and laugh and the like, and the newsroom was right next to us. But when this ended, we realized that we were the only ones in the studio. The studio was empty, but for us. And we realized, we looked through the window, and we could see that everyone was sitting around or standing around television in the newsroom. And I looked at her, and she looked at me. Her name was Jennifer. And she said, "What is going on?" And so we unhooked our microphones and our earpieces, and we walk in, and we see, of course, the North Tower. Mm-hmm. And it's on fire. And we're just kind of standing around, and we're saying, what's going on? And someone says that a plane has crashed. And like you were saying, Sonia, we're thinking someone has crashed, a single-engine Cessna. being news people, we realize that this has happened before, and we're thinking, how could this happen again? Mm-hmm. This is just absolutely ridiculous, but man, this was just such a mess. And then when we saw a replay of the first crash and everyone said, whoa, and then this had to be a mechanical problem. And then, of course, when the South Tower was hit, and this was just one of the most incredible moments, our news director, he said, this is a terrorist attack. And you have to understand, there were about 10 people in the newsroom at this time. It's still the morning. And we all looked at him at the same time, and we were all incredulous because no one believed him. Mm. And he said, yep, this is a terrorist attack. He said, everyone back into the studio, everyone back on air. And we were on the air until the morning team, including myself and my co-anchor, we were on the air until about 3 o'clock, until the afternoon team came in. And just sitting there and watching the towers collapse, and of course, you know, the Pentagon being hit. And for me, being a, you know, a native Washingtonian, it really hit home for me because I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, this is home. Mm-hmm. This is happening at home. And then of course, the plane crash in Shanksville. But, you know, from the perspective of, you know, of a reporter, as a journalist, none of this, and I think, Andrea, you can perhaps relate to this as well. Mm-hmm. You're doing our jobs, and instead of reporting at 3 a.m. as we always did the very next day, we were coming in at 11 o'clock the next night for a show that was starting at 5 a.m. Mm-hmm. And we did that for 2 weeks straight. But it was only after that that one day I was sitting on my sofa still watching what was happening in New York and trying to pick up the pieces at the Pentagon. And finally, I just fell apart on my sofa 2 weeks mm-hmm. after all of this. And it just it, I think it changed all of us. It changed America. Obviously, not just how we travel, but I think it changed how we looked at each other then. And even today, I would argue, Sonia, that there's so much good that as Americans came out of this, but also the racism that mm-hmm. that blossomed after this, the way we looked at Muslims, or the ignorant way that many of us looked at people who we thought were Muslims who were not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I recall very clearly post 9/11 was, and it just seemed almost immediate murder of a man who was a Sikh Indian, I believe.
Yeah.
Who was singled out and killed because he wore a turban. Being a Sikh, that's what he wore, and they killed him for that, believing somehow that he was a Muslim terrorist. And that was one of the earliest moments where I, as a journalist, said, we have to do a better job of informing and educating through media, because that was raw ignorance that cost this gentleman his life. And it put me on a course where I was thinking, what can I, as a journalist, do to better inform America and Americans about the true diverse nature of the world around them? I remained with the White House beat for another 9 months or so after 9/11. But then I transitioned into what we called World Services, which took news from Washington and prepared it for a global audience. At the time, I was working for the Associated Press. When I was on the White House beat, I was a White House reporter for the Associated Press. So I transferred over to World Services to try to build a bridge with audiences that are just very different. And from that, my career trajectory went on over into establishing specialized race and ethnicity news coverage about this demographic transformation that's underway in the United States, because the complexion of this nation was changing, and it was happening in concert with this country getting accustomed to what had just happened in terms of terrorism on domestic soil here in this country. And I think that played a large factor in why we've seen an erosion in that togetherness on what it means to be an American, and that patriotism, that automatic default to patriotism right after 9/11 just has not seemed to be here now with what we are dealing with in terms of the blossoming of or the reemergence of nationalism and white supremacy in these modern times.
Andrea,
Al-Qaeda came for the World Trade Center. They did not come to the Capitol, but it was folks who were born and raised here who came for the Capitol.
You know, Andrea, one of the things that, as we look back some 20 years, and this is a thing that is really interesting to me, how some of the big personalities that evolved from that day, two in particular, have changed. George Bush, President Bush, and Rudy Giuliani. Rudy Giuliani was considered America's mayor, if not before 9/11, definitely as a result of it. Mm-hmm. The backbone that we saw from him on that day, the symbolism, the so-called stand-up guy that he was at that time, and what he has become since then. And also the... George Bush was a very partisan individual prior to 9/11, and now he has become, at least in the views of many people, Republicans and Democrats, a like in the words of his father, a kinder, gentler person.
Yeah, they certainly, I think, took divergent paths, and it's difficult because, obviously, you know, the legacy of Afghanistan and the mess that's there and the horror that's there has to go back and kind of land squarely on President Bush's lap. And so while I really value the, you know, the kinder, gentler part, and then Rudy Giuliani going from this kind of plateau of America's, you know, mayor, although I think New Yorkers knew there were some other undercurrents there. We didn't completely buy that. We're a little cynical here. I grew up in Cincinnati, but, you know, I've been in New York a long time. So I was gullible first. I had that Ohio part. But in him becoming, you know, just in my mind, I'm sorry, a very odious character, and the kind of blending then with what happened in 2016 when we had a candidate who really got a lot of mileage out of saying Islam hates us, which is such an ignorant statement in and of itself. So, yeah, it is strange the way things have turned, because I am telling you, at Ground Zero, people of all faiths, all colors, all walks of life were pulled together. And in my heart and faith, they were really walking in God's shoes as they walked that site, as they picked through the rubble with their bare hands for any particle, any bone, any part of someone, a tooth that might offer a family some comfort. And yet I also have to wonder if those planes had hit a housing project in the Bronx, had they hit a nursing home in Brooklyn, would our response have been the same? But they hit us at the heart of capitalism as well, and we kind of pulled together, which was a beautiful thing. But, you know, we have seen so much violence towards people of color since then. I mean, that's our legacy of this country, but we have seen it. And I think Spike Lee has said basically that September 11th was a pre-existing condition. Mm. So, you know, it's the enemy came from outside. And so we pulled together. We all always seem to need an outside enemy to pull together as a country. And when the enemy is within us, our own racism, our own xenophobia, you know, our own drive for profit, when the enemy is inside of us, how do we fight that? How do we pull together? And that's the hard part.
In the title of your book, it says Reflections of Grace, mm-hmm. and Finding Hope at Ground Zero. In writing the book, what was the hopeful moment that you found there? I know just this week the reporting that bone fragments, mm-hmm. they're still identifying,
yes.
people, some 1,000 people still unidentified from September 11th, but bit by bit, technology identifying people. But again, what is your state of grace some 20 years mm-hmm. later from that point?
I think, again, remembering the courage and the true, altruistic acts of people who knew they were putting their lives on the line by being there, by breathing that toxic air. I myself got cancer after serving at Ground Zero, and I think the hope was this young Port Authority officer, Rudy, who said, this was still someone's son, so we respected that body. That gave me hope, because that was like right in the heat of the worst of it. And also just looking in the eyes of other service people, men and women, who there was still some light there, that they were going to serve as well as they could and go home to the families and try to continue to make a difference. And I think my job as a chaplain was that help rekindle those inner pilot lights that had maybe gone out and hopefully encourage the ones that were still there, that life was worth living, that life is meaningful, that God is present. Whether we live or we die, God is present, that we're not alone. And sometimes we are that hand of God for each other. And that's what I saw there.
Sonja, final word from you. When you reflect on this day, what are your thoughts? How do you cope in remembering?
I usually spend September 11th itself being very quiet. I just sort of stay within. I typically pop up on Twitter on various people's threads, but mainly I'm home, I'm quiet and reflective. I don't do a whole lot of public observance or anything like that. I actually have yet to go to Ground Zero. In the days right after, I considered it just too emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since then, it's just been hard for me to say, okay, I think I have it in me now to go. I keep it very quiet. It is my hope that this nation does not forget. For at least the first 5 years afterward, I said, there's no way we could forget. But as we've rolled up on this now 20th anniversary, I can see signs that we are forgetting what this cost us as a nation, and just the sheer sacrifice from a human standpoint. And so we all have to, I think, redouble our efforts to make sure this lesson of history is not forgotten, so future generations won't be doomed to repeat it.
Yeah, and I think mm-hmm. we would be remiss if we did not, mention that it began with 9/11, but there is the legacy of Afghanistan and the members of the military and those contractors and government workers who lost their lives over these 20 years, and the trillions of dollars that was spent in the aftermath of 9/11, overseas, and the tens of thousands of Afghans who also lost their lives. All of this is something for us to think about. Andrea Rayer and Sonja Ross, thank you both for talking to us tonight. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
That is The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Friday, September 10th. For News Director Renee Nash, reporters Millette Green, Bramante Bryan, producer Candace Atkins, and engineer Bobby Adams. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night, and have a wonderful weekend.